All right, so we're kicking this off. Again, appreciate all you guys jumping into this and being industry experts who want to participate in the UNLV program. This is Unit 11 for the introduction to sports betting, focusing on venture capital, angel investors, and all the things we've seen develop around the industry over the last 4 or 5 years, particularly since PASPA was found to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States. And I say that, though, not just a reference to the U.S., because we've seen what started here as a growth in this space, but also we see it extending quite globally as well, right? I think everyone has seen inbounds or has been involved in deals, not only in the U.S., but certainly in the Americas and Asia and Europe as well. So when we think about some of these questions we're going to start going through, feel free to provide responses on a global basis or specific as well. But let's start off with Seth. Great to have you on, given your busy schedule. And I just want to call out that, like, not only have you had like a very successful and storied history, and I think the broader gaming industry, from land-based casinos to overseas, at big corporate levels, you're also a founder and an investor in many ideas and companies that are related to the sports betting industry. So one question I wanted to kick this off with and ask you is, like, focusing on your role as a founder and an investor, how do you think about, or how do you determine which ideas or innovations are worthy of your time or your investment?
Sure. So I think it's important that any business I start or spend meaningful time in is something that impacts me on a regular basis. So generally, my businesses are integrated with gambling, hospitality, the things that I'm most familiar with. I usually tend to have wanted to experience the problem myself and not just take somebody else's word for it, that the problem is real. It also gives me a sense if the problem is really solvable or if, you know, the idea is, you know, a little too innovative. You know, I like evolution, not revolution. At least, you know, I think there's a more likely success if I'm just trying to, you know, evolve something with my business.
Are there any particular attributes when you're looking at a company? Is it the team that you look for first? Is it, like you said, the problem that's being solved? Is it something that's a today issue?
Sure.
How do you look at that?
Look, it's a cliche, right? I mean, that it's all about the team, but that's, you know, because it's true, right? An idea, in my opinion, is only as valuable as one's ability to execute it. Am I allowed to curse? Who's, you know, am I going to offend
you? UNLV will edit that out, but go ahead. Yeah.
All right. Well, because you know, I coined a phrase and it just doesn't sound as good unless I, you know, say it this way. You know, I only think somebody should be able to think outside of the box if they know how to build the fucking box in the first place. And I mean that sincerely. I've seen a lot of people with great ideas, but they're a little unrealistic. And I, you know, tend to want to align myself with professionals that I believe, you know, understand the industry that they're trying to evolve, right? I don't want to say disrupt, but evolve. And I think it's important to, you know, understand the basics and the foundation before you try to completely reinvent whatever industry you're involved in.
I kind of want to open that up, Benji. What do you think about that? Right? What do you think about? Is particularly that you got to be able to build a box before you can change the box.
Well, sure. I mean, you want to be able to build a box before you change it. So I agree with that to an extent. But I think there's also, you know, if you want to, taking a hockey analogy, being the Canadian in the room, Wayne Gretzky used to say he scores a lot of goals by skating to where the puck was going to be as opposed to where the puck is today. I think that's applicable for many industries and certainly applicable for our industry, that you want to be able to look a couple of years ahead in terms of here's where we are today, here's where the industry is headed, and having a strong conviction in terms of what the needs are going to be, not just today, but 12 to 24 to 36 months down the line, and begin angling as entrepreneurs your products and your deliverables to where the industry is headed as opposed to where the industry has been. So, you know, I think there's a component to what Seth is saying that I'm entirely in agreement with, but I think there's also a component of needing to be forward thinking and not in an unrealistic manner, because if you get too far ahead and try to get to where the industry is going to be in 10 or 15 years, you need to, as a business, have a staying power to withstand the ups and downs and trying to, you know, make the adjustments to get there. But you certainly want to be thinking ahead in terms of where you want to be going as opposed to where we are today.
Yeah, just to qualify, that makes a lot of sense. You know, for example, I've seen people that are trying to create technology for the restaurant business and never worked in a restaurant. And look, it could happen, right? I'm not saying, of course, there's an exception, but, it, you know, I would rather work with people who understand intimately the area that they're trying to transform. That doesn't mean they had to have worked in a restaurant for 20 years, but man, it'd be nice if they worked in a restaurant for a little bit. So that's all I meant.
Yeah, you know, look, I mean, if you go back, you know, 15, 20 years ago out in Europe when, you know, people were betting on games and, you know, all of a sudden some technology came out towards betting during the game as opposed to before the game. And that was thought of as perhaps not evolutionary, but revolutionary at the time. And many people thought it wouldn't be applicable and wouldn't work. And more recently, we saw that here in the U.S. with the emergence of some of the micro betting companies, where there was initially a lot of resistance on part of the operators who were like, okay, well, in-play wagering is going to be a thing, but betting on moments within the game, I'm not sure about that. And now it's becoming pretty mainstream. So I think that those that are thinking ahead of it and where things are going to be, those would be some examples of that.
Yeah, and that's great. And I think talking about skating to the puck, Scott, you know, to where the puck is going to be, I think it's important to call out, I think, for a moment, as we talk about the venture capital investment side, what you've done with EBCI, right? And do you want to take a second to talk about, I think, effectively launching the first privately managed venture capital fund for a tribal nation in the U.S.? And then kind of to tie into these comments we're having here around what do we look for, maybe turning that into or taking that into looking at some of the companies we've talked about or we looked at as part of the VC fund. But I think first understanding like who EBCI is really important, because that in itself is a startup of innovation that I think we're going to see more of these coming.
Yeah, absolutely. EBCI is, for those that don't know, is, you know, if you were to rank the success of the tribe that are in the casino business, you know, they're probably a top three operator in the country. I mean, just a massive success. They launched in 97, so they're 23 years old at this point and growing as their portfolio continues to grow. I have the good fortune of managing those operations through the 21 years I spent with Caesars and then went to work directly for the tribe 3 years ago. So literally the tech fund kind of came at happenstance, I think, through conversations with yourself, Quentin, and Chris Grove and others in the industry. We were out actually in our first commercial acquisition in Caesars Southern Indiana. That property came with three market access licenses on the sports betting side. So we went out kind of fishing for potential market access partners. And as we were doing our research and network roundabouts, we learned that there was a lot of innovative startup companies entering the gaming space that from an operational standpoint, we said we can add value. That not only can we kind of nature and nurture these businesses through our bricks and mortar operations, but they actually serve a purpose with our stakeholders. They can create efficiencies on the employment front, efficiencies for customers, and efficiencies for our shareholders. So that kind of fit the box of what we were looking at. And then I think just carrying on from the other conversation, what Seth and Benji were alluding to, I think Connectify, one of the investments in our portfolio, is a perfect example of that. So traditionally, the AML software, right, for AML compliance was bank-related. Nobody had ever taken time to write specific language from a casino industry standpoint. And, you know, we were able to make that investment and become the first product test site in the portfolio.
Yeah, and I think part of that thesis that we worked on there, which is really interesting, is, as you called out, like how do we add incremental or accretive value, not necessarily from investment alone, but from the ecosystem that is being built as a part of the EBCI and an innovative private company launch, right? And Connectify is the one you're referring to, but that's a great example of testing it directly in the market and saying, here's someone, to what Seth and Benji said, who had direct experience working on this inside of the industry. And then said, let me take this and advance this into a product, a digital product, and move it out of manual processes. And he's done a really good job at that as well.
Yeah, I think, and a lot more than if somebody was in New York, in finance, understood AML, and said, oh, I'm going to apply this to the casino business. They might have, but the fact that ConnectFi was born out of a, you know, a Las Vegas accounting room, I think is why it is special and one of the reasons it'll be successful.
Yeah. So the, and Chris, kind of going back in time, right? If you go back when you and I had less gray hair and we were showing up at Nevada Gaming Control Board meetings, pre-PASPA coming down and building some of the first kind of market predictions for the size of the U.S. sports betting market, you know, it's been a very interesting journey. You've done some great things as a founder of multiple companies that have exited, and also as an investor on the venture capital side. If you kind of had to step back and look at the last 5 years or so, how would you describe what's been driving the sports betting sector? Or how would you describe that period of growth? And was it small and went big? Is it small and went broad? Like, how do you think about that now?
One of the defining characteristics driving that growth, I think, has been how sports betting served as a catalyst for folks who might not have been interested in gambling to become interested in gambling. And we saw that across a number of vectors. A lot of founders who in 2015 might have said, I'm going to do fintech, I'm going to do healthcare, I'm going to do something more consumer tech focused, post-PASPA started looking at gambling as a legitimate avenue for their entrepreneurial ambitions. Similarly, we saw a lot of capital deployers who might have looked at gambling as something a little too old, a little too calcified, a little too risky, suddenly become interested in deploying in the space and all the way up to the public markets as well. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of valuations that you can get for a DraftKings and that multiple versus the multiples that are more traditionally associated with retail operators like Boyd or Golden. So I think one of the defining characteristics of the growth, the excitement, the energy of the post-PASPA era has really been that infusion of talent and of capital into the gambling industry from sources that before the Supreme Court's decision might not have thought of gambling as a viable outlet for their energy, their ambition, or their dollars.
In certain groups, I still see the reluctance or the hesitancy, right? In some groups, in fact, they have a strict prohibition on investing in the quote-unquote gaming gambling industry. And you know, I'd have to reaffirm as well what you said. If you go back 4 or 5 years ago, you really couldn't find, I mean, maybe outside of, you know, Seth, right? But you maybe couldn't find that much in terms of angel investors and certainly not formalized VC groups who were focusing on the space. And even with the first company I left to go found, like you had to bootstrap it because it was very hard to find anyone. And to the extent that there's anyone who wanted to invest, it was like it was an angel check, which is great. But that was like the extent of trying to garner interest from people in related industries or from within the industry to kind of build something. I mean, kind of opening up to the group, like, why do you think investors are interested now? We've seen a downturn in valuations. We've seen a downturn in companies who were invested in terms of breaking out of, like, if you will, the valley of death. Like, do you think we're going to have continued interest across this from VC and from angel investors and then moving more into larger IPOs? Or where do we see that moving?
I mean, I could take a stab at that one, Quentin. I think that, you know, when we, this industry really opened up in 2018, there was a huge flurry of excitement, which led to, many would say, augmented valuations and unrealistic exits that just wasn't really sustainable. And then as the economy began to turn the other way, it kind of led to it being very difficult for a lot of companies to either exit and or raise capital. And it caused, you know, almost as the thing kind of went up that way, as the market began to face some challenges, it really doubled down more on this industry, perhaps than even some other industries. And now we're climbing back up, you know, and it's interesting. But I think that, you know, as you look at one of the things that when I hear Chris describing what he was previously, one of the things that's interesting to me is that really from the moment that sports betting opened up and in some other states, iGaming, this has become culturally acceptable a lot faster than I thought it would be. And I think that when you see something become culturally acceptable, and sports betting was a bad word 10 years ago, the league shied away from it and the public shied away from it. And pretty quickly, the leagues adapted a tolerance and then an embracing of this industry, in parts because of the financial opportunity, and in part because I think people are realizing that sports betting and forms of gambling are a form of engagement, and it can enhance the entire sports experience. And I think that now that we're climbing back out of some of the challenging periods economically, and we're seeing some more realistic unit economics, I think we'll gradually see more and more investment come into the space, but it won't come out of left field the way that it did when the whole thing was initially repealed and people jumped into it. It'll be a little bit more gradual as people begin to see realistic unit economics returning to the space.
Yeah, I would add too, from an operational standpoint, right, just looking at the history of our industry, you had kind of in a very brief summarized fashion, I lived in Las Vegas during the 90s as the Strip transformed, right? And it really elevated the destination base of Las Vegas. Then you went into the kind of the riverboat kind of period of about 20 years where expansion happened across the country. And you had some regional destination markets, but for the most part, regional markets with high frequency visitation of customers. Sports betting and iGaming is the next best thing, right? They're evolving in the industry. So I think there's a lot of excitement. And then you couple that with the digitization of everything and our world around us and the desire and the demand for content. I think it's just a natural fit, and it will continue to evolve at a rapid pace. So I think just that within itself, what's happening in the environment as a whole, will continue to draw interest from an investment standpoint.
You guys think in terms of like the next phase of growth, because it feels like describing what we've seen in the last 4 years, really like the first inning, right? It seems still very early. Do you think the next round of growth is going to come out of, on the investment side, successful investments that mature at exits, and then there's more capital to be deployed? Or do you think on the investment side, we're going to see new funds, new monies get involved in the space? Between those two, which do you think drives this next round of, if you will, startups and growth?
It'll likely be a mix, but I suspect it'll be more of the former than the latter. I do think you are going to need to see some exits and some recapitalization from those exits, and also the momentum that additional exits generate in terms of engendering additional funding, additional founding, and then, of course, the infusion of that capital back into the ecosystem as founders with successful exits tend to, a number of folks on this call fit this characterization, tend to reinvest in the industry that they know. As I think Benji said a few minutes ago, I don't know that you're going to see that sort of from the clouds level of funding reemerge. I think that was a perfect storm of the light switch of the Supreme Court decision, maybe some irrational exuberance to borrow a phrase from the 90s and bring it forward 30 years around how big the market was going to be. And maybe a misunderstanding fundamentally of the economics of the market, the value chain of the market, et cetera. I do think that counterbalancing that, as a few folks have made the point, will be the normalization of this activity, which will help to weaken or remove some of those vice clauses at larger funds, whether they're formal clauses prohibiting funds from investing or more informal clauses that lessen or diminish excitement. But I do think the primary driver of the next wave, the next surge of investment, enthusiasm, and energy is going to come as you see more exits like the Angstrom exit, right? As you see more transactions like the NEO transaction with Aristocrat, as you see these bigger ticket transactions, that begets momentum, that begets energy, and I think that drives people to build new things because it gives them, and to fund new things because it gives them a much clearer target, a much deeper tank of fuel to pursue those ambitions.
And I'll add one point to that, is that we need to bear in mind that the public markets remain relatively dormant. And I think that another driver of all this, you know, there's not as much optionality today in all industries as hopefully there will be when the public markets return and IPOs become more the norm again. And right now, that isn't really part of the optionality of an exit strategy right now. the exit is who can I sell to? But I think that as the public markets return and IPOs become a little bit more the norm, not just in our space, but across the board in all industries, that that could really become interesting in terms of how private equity looks at our space and other and the bigger VC firms that maybe right now are shying away.
Yeah, that brief moment of SPAC period was very interesting too, right? I mean, I think it was like SPAC conversations every week for a moment in time. We probably saw two or three that went successfully out the door and sustained themselves. But I felt, to your point, Benji, I felt like a lot of the interest as it expanded as well was once public markets started becoming aware of the potential size of just sports betting alone in the U.S., where before it was highly ethereal. But once we got a couple states to legalize and we saw numbers coming off of that, I think that's what drove a lot of that interest and which drove that SPAC wave as well and drove as many people on the startup side as the angel VC side trying to get into the space. Probably less smaller group on that side, though. I always found that was fascinating to kind of see that. But I think if you step out of it, I think what's common between this group and I think effectively when we think about the VC angel space in this industry, everyone probably knows each other because it's all people to Seth's point from the industry who have been there on the inside. And so maybe it's fair to say that there's some type of competitive edge in terms of understanding how these companies work and how the industries work. One proposition I would put out there is that, you know, the J-curve growth of the sports betting industry as regulated in the United States and the ability to capture that, right, is different from growing a startup in this space. The time horizon on a startup to get the wheels on the bus, to get that thing to go live, to start generating revenue, versus the timeline that it took for existing businesses who were operating already in the United States to also turn on those engines were two different things. And I would suppose, or my supposition would be, is that as analysts and markets looked at the J-curve of experienced existing companies growing in this newly regulated space, maybe that had some overlay or some overlap to the startup space as well, because those two paths are not the same. But I think there was, to your point, exuberance seeing this side also impact the second side. I think that's probably a fair supposition. Let's see, what do you guys think? Good, maybe. Yes, no?
It's one of those where I think all of us had something to say, but we're waiting for everyone else to start. So we were all going to be silent for 15 seconds, and then I'll start talking at once. I think that is a fair supposition. I do think there's an important overlay that is suggested by your commentary there as well, which is not misunderstanding how venture might work in a much larger segment, like general consumer tech, with how venture works in what is ultimately a much smaller segment, regulated gambling, whether you're looking at the U.S. or globally. It is large in terms of absolute dollars, but it is a fraction of the kinds of consumer activity you see around general tech. You think about, just as an example, the largest company by market cap in our industry, Las Vegas Sands, right, or Evolution or DraftKings at their height, they are rounding errors on the valuation of an Amazon or a Google. And so that entire ecosystem of how big is the end market? How large are the end acquirers? How early do those end acquirers drop down for acquisitions? To Benji's point, what are the realistic exit opportunities for a startup? Still very lucrative for founders and potentially for investors, but I don't know that there's really ever an Uber or a Twitter or a Meta. DraftKings is the closest thing to that, and DraftKings is arguably a once in a generation, if not a once in a century company, just in terms of its timing, its trajectory, and how it stumbled into a much larger opportunity than it was ever really designed to capture or guaranteed to capture. A lot of words there. I think the simple point is when you think about venture and gambling, a lot of people make the mistake of saying, okay, we'll just transfer our understanding of venture from tech or another segment where venture is an established part of the ecosystem. The reality is that the floor, the ceiling, all of those things are much different for venture within regulated gambling than they are within some other sectors.
One other point to build upon that, and I'd really love to, I'd be curious, Scott and Seth, on your views on this, is that when you think in terms of the industry, specifically if you look at the U.S. market today, we're seeing some, you know, I think a lot of what dictates investor appetite going forward will also depend on the legislative path forward, in particular as it relates to iCasino. I think a lot of folks on the investment side, particularly who are evaluating B2C sportsbook activity, see challenging unit economics. They see a number of tier twos that maybe aren't making it the way they thought they might have, or closing their doors altogether. They see less winners than there are losers. Maybe I got that backwards, but you know what I'm trying to say. But as we see the emergence of more iCasino and more states adopting iCasino, where the unit economics are a lot more favorable, you know, it'll be interesting as we see, and hopefully we will see, more and more states open up to that, and or additional forms of real money gaming, be it fantasy or other, that have a better legislative, a more cohesive legislative path forward, that really opens up the TAM in a more meaningful way. And that really could play into investor appetite moving forward, as well as some of these other areas of less challenging unit economics than the realities of sportsbook to date.
Yeah, I mean, look, as a traditional land-based operator at my core, you know, the idea of a federal gaming tax has always been like our worst nightmare. But the fact that we have a state-by-state approach to regulated gaming is one of the reasons why there won't be an Uber. That alone creates the inability for one company to really be nationwide, even though DraftKings, yes, to some degree, but it makes it much, much more challenging from both a regulatory and technological perspective. And I don't see that changing.
And to your, I want to put this actually on my topics I wanted to cover off later, but maybe we skip ahead, referring off of your question, Benji, to Seth and Scott, right? So we've seen what sports betting has done regulated in the U.S. Before PASPA, we used to try and figure out how much will be sports betting in person versus sports betting online. I think we clearly have our answer now with the U.S. We're like 99, 98x online mobile sports betting. Retail is trending towards a single percent for numerous reasons, right? With variations. iGaming in the states that iGaming is regulated and legal in the U.S., let's just set aside alt gaming and unregulated or offshore gaming for a second. If you look at the unit economics, to Benji's point, of a casino player versus a sports player, we're seeing like 2.5x revenue per adult on an iGaming player versus a sports player. Of course, this can fluctuate. There could be changes depending on who's doing the measurement, but it's fair to say iGaming players net on a revenue basis are more valuable at a multiple over a sports player. But now we're seeing this convergence, as we all knew was coming, as it relates to land-based. That's the part I want to focus on first, right? How, from a land-based perspective, do you see interacting? This is a quasi-investment question, but you know, how do you see, from the land-based perspective, interacting with digital gaming or digital sports betting and that crossover there? Does that become, like, from the investment point of view, do you say, look, I'm no longer going to invest and build in land-based casinos because iGaming and sports is growing so heavily? Or do you say, no, land-based will always have a place, here's why? Like, how do you differentiate, or how do you kind of define those two sectors?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, Quinn, and you know this well from some of the work that we've done directly, that you're going to need an omni-channel solution, and that includes your bricks and mortar with some sort of online digital presence. How you get there depends on the size, scale, and scope of your operations, right? Some of the companies, the Caesars, the MGMs of the world, right, can in-house or in-source, you know, their product portfolio. Companies like ours, where we're a startup, where we have 3 commercial licenses and 2 tribal licenses, we typically defer to market access, right, through partnerships. And I think it's the right strategy in the short term. In the long run, as the portfolio grows, we can think about alternate options. But I think not having a presence in states where you have access to online mobile sports betting and then iGaming, I think you'll be left behind, because it's an entirely different customer base. And we've even talked about, as mundane as this may sound, the geographical presence. You take the state of New Jersey with casinos in the southern part of the state where the population concentration is in the northern part of the state. We're almost identical in our license in Indiana, right? We sit on the southern tip of the state where the population base is in the central and northeastern part of the state. So having an online presence opens us up to customer access that we typically wouldn't have saw in our bricks and mortar operations.
Yeah, I think it also has to do with tax rate, both for iGaming and land base. So I don't think what you're asking, Quentin, is are we comparing somebody playing online slots on BetMGM versus somebody walking into a room and only playing a slot machine? The land-based casino is so much more than just that slot machine. And as long as the land-based casinos, especially here in Las Vegas with our low tax rate, can build experiences that are so special and interesting and unique and fun, they're always going to be a part of the equation. If there are other states that make it very difficult for a land-based casino to generate profit because the tax rate's too high and labor gets too expensive and so on and so forth, and that business model isn't as good as the iGaming margin, then I think that gets a little tricky.
So it's fair to say that investing in land-based, if you will, brick-and-mortar opportunities or operations is looked at through a different lens than investing into someone who would be, for example, in the digital-only space as an innovation or startup. Two different categories. There's overlap, but two different categories.
Incredibly different. I mean, the integrated resort, the slot machine is but a piece of the whole equation. On the flip side, one of the reasons that the mobile sportsbook operators haven't been able to differentiate their products is because how do you do that on mobile? There's only so much you can do to differentiate. And I think there's just such a big difference. So yes, as Scott mentioned, you know, it's a cliche, but I agree with him. The omnichannel approach that does make sense. And I think that regional operators haven't fully leveraged their properties in a way. There's only a couple of them, and they're having their own challenges for their own reasons. So it's very much early. I'm surprised that it's taken this long for operators that have bricks and mortar to leverage them in a more meaningful way. I just can't believe that that's not an advantage. The numbers tell me I'm wrong, right? DraftKings will look at me, Jason Robbins, you're wrong, Seth. Look at me. I don't have a single meaningful brick and mortar, and I am number one. So today, I'm wrong. I think the jury's still out, and more will be revealed.
Yeah, one caveat to that, this conversation is the conversation we had earlier, federal legislation versus state by state. And using the DraftKings or ourselves as two completely different examples, right? If DraftKings didn't have market access in states where they're forced to, so they're tethered to a bricks and mortar license, that's a very different profile of a company. And the same for us, right? If we could do everything ourselves and have direct market access for the right economics, we would certainly opt that way. So I think, again, as you start to study this industry and say that the regulatory hurdles, your cost of entry into the market is going to also have to be something everybody's going to have to study very hard on a state-by-state basis.
And Scott, I'll throw on top of that, that when you start thinking in terms of the investment side and some of the larger VC firms and the private equity guys, as they begin assessing this industry, one of the things they have to consider is exactly that, the state-by-state piece and the legislative requirements and you know, how much elbow juice, if they want to own a significant chunk of this company, over 5%, then they have to open up their skirts, and so to speak, and for legislative purposes, be prepared to go through a very, very diligent process that isn't necessarily consistent on a state-by-state basis. And that can be something that might scare away some folks who otherwise might have an interest in putting some capital into the space.
That is certainly one of the hurdles to cover off in some of these early years. I think we've smoothed it out over time, but a lot of the VCs or people who were willing to invest at whatever level weren't aware of this thing called regulation and gaming licenses. And we've all been in many, many conversations on both sides of the fence, seeking investment or working on one, where you have to walk through that conversation with somebody and say, by the way, here's what the gaming industry looks like. Here's what your license looks like. And here's what you have to apply and send in. So I think we've gotten more or less more as a broader industry in the investment side comfortable with that concept. I don't know what you guys think, but I think we still encounter that even today where some people are shocked at the level of inquiry.
Quentin, there's no shortage. I can't tell you how many VCs that I deal with that as they look at a deal, if they love the deal, they're like, I want 4.99%, 4.95%. And then they do the exact same thing when it comes to their pro rata. They just don't want to go above that 5% threshold for the reasons that we've outlined.
Yeah, which is not a magical threshold, but you know, it's a theoretical threshold. But since we said legislation and regulation so many times, yeah, I kind of want to take this investment slant on this for a second. I feel like I should have done legislation bingo on this call. So, you know, we all know that this industry has been defined by historically the rules of the road, right? The internal controls, the legislation, the regulation, more or less as I've tended to describe it over time, maybe less so now. But it's one of these industries that you do what you're told you can allow to do, what you're allowed to do in the U.S., as opposed to if it doesn't say you can't do it, you do it. So gaming as a regulated industry in the U.S. sometimes takes a different approach. So like when you look at products to invest in or companies to invest in, and sometimes, and it's obviously a very busy topic now in 2023 around what kind of a game is this? What kind of a product is this? What we used to see is fairly clear lines. A slot machine on a casino floor, a table game on a casino floor, a sports book on the floor. These things were very easily discernible, right? A lottery ticket. The underlying math behind these things we understood was different. A class two versus a class three versus a lottery versus RNG. And so we were able to very clearly, I think, articulate what different types of gaming was, even within the gambling sector. And this was not as much of an issue because it was defined at a state level. But then when digital technology came around with all these new products and new companies, we're seeing that technology is enabling, if you will, the crossover or what looks like the interplay between what used to be separate categories of gaming, definable categories and understandable categories when you play the game. When you look at a new game or a new product, how important is that lens initially? Like, do I need to know where you fit? Or do I need to know the business model first? I'll start there. There's probably 1,000 questions we could riff off of that. But how much of understanding the gaming product and where it sits in this regulated ecosystem matters? Or is it just, if it's unregulated, it's unregulated?
It's all just risk, right? It's all flavors of risk. You break out your scale and you've got regulatory risk. You've got competitive risk, execution risk. I think that it's a form of risk that people might focus on and perhaps over-index on because it feels a little more visible or visceral. And in some cases, it can be existential. But for us as investors, it really is one of maybe a dozen or two types of risk that we think about. And then you weigh that risk against the return. Like I said, there are certainly outliers where you might look at something and go, that's it. The amount of risk there, the optical quality of this product is just such that I can't get over it in terms of where I think it's going to sit within the regulatory structure. Those outliers aside, we think about that spectrum of clearly regulated and defined. Over to, as I think I'm going to give Seth credit for coining the term, a pre-regulation product. Bunch of points in between those two poles. And for us, it's just another risk factor. And again, one of a couple dozen.
Scott or Benji, anyone else thoughts on that? It's a topic that continues to cross, I think, a lot of our emails.
Take a little kind of left-hand turn here, give you an anecdote about just the need for continued investment into technology. So going back 20 years, I was running Harrah's Atlantic City, and then we created an IT steering committee with Caesars, which I was part of the onset of that, because we knew our systems were antiquated, right? We were a legacy company that for the most part wrote proprietary software that was developed in the late 80s into the 90s. So we needed to innovate. So we went out and we created a partnership with Microsoft and a couple other companies. But we went to Microsoft and said, we need these things. They need to be tangible, right? Or they need to be developed for self, you know, check-in kiosk at hotels. And lo and behold, Microsoft came to us and they created this thing they called Surface. And back then it was this, it was like the size of a tabletop, right? Like where you could put four people around it. And we ended up testing this thing in our bars and restaurants at Harrah's Atlantic City and at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And we didn't know what to do with it. Tech was cool. You could throw your loyalty card program on it and it would immediately recognize who you were, open up your comp account, and you could start charging drinks. It had a flirt feature on it. So if you saw a person across the bar that you wanted to get to know, you could hit flirt to that table, send them a drink. So it had all this cool tech that you could upload and download credits and create automated comp solutions. Well, we tested it and it failed miserably, right? It lasted in our properties for like 6 months and nobody knew what the hell to do with it. And it went away. Well, lo and behold, so this is again in the early 2000s, Apple comes out with an iPad and Microsoft goes, this is the Surface, right? But Apple was in front of them. So Surface, as you know, years later became a tablet size thing, but we had this cool technology that nobody knew what to do with. We knew it created some automated features for the customers and the employees. But I think that story kind of always leads me to say that if you're not out there innovating and looking for the next best thing, you don't know what's out there from an efficiency standpoint. So whether it's creating operational efficiencies on the cost side of the business or incremental revenue generators, or quite frankly, new customer segments that are just looking for that early adopter engagement. And I think labs like Las Vegas are perfect to continue to innovate and test this type of stuff. And that's really the essence of what we're doing through our fund, is finding some of it is literally bricks and mortar. How do I create efficiencies and save money or enhance our revenue? And other things are, what's the next best thing that we can do in the industry to continuously engage our customers?
Yeah, certainly.
I think that,
yeah, certainly in my experience too, is like if there are new products, if there is new innovation, I 100% agree, we should be forward thinking and pushing the envelope. If we have to change the regulations, if we have to change the laws, you know, that's something that we have individually as groups and different projects embraced and pushed. Seth, I know for example, been a heavy supporter of obviously lots of different changes in Nevada's regulatory structure to drive through innovation. But you were about to say something. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but
yeah, sure. No, first of all, Scott, I can't believe that Surface was 20 plus years ago. Doesn't feel that long ago. If we look at the traditional gambling business, we brought up the 4.9% and Microsoft. So I want to tell a story. You know, many people don't know that in the early Mirage days, late 80s, Bill Gates owned 4.9% of Mirage Resorts to stay under that threshold and was instrumental in building a proprietary yield rate management system for Steve Wynn, because Mirage was, you know, the biggest hotel in the world and there wasn't any good software to do revenue management for a 3,000-room hotel. I bring that up because I think that's a good example of technology that was created for a mature business. So as Chris said earlier, all these early businesses that spun up in 2018, they were guessing what the industry would be like. They were guessing they knew what the economics looked like, and many, many were wrong. So, you know, we are in the early days, but I think there'll be a whole bunch of new technologies that we'll see over the next couple of years once we have a better idea of what, you know, the needs are for a more mature online gaming industry.
Yeah, and that's a great segue, Benji. I wanted to flip something to you. I mean, you led at Donbass, you know, one of the, how do you really shape or call the history of Donbass, right? But you led one of the industry's long-standing products that not only was focused on U.S. sports betting, which back then was something unique, right? Especially on the data side, but also on a global basis as well. So I would want to kick this to you and say, like, you know, to Seth's point, kind of taking this conversation back towards, you know, our investment theses or what we think about in product innovation, I would throw two things at you. One, having been a product leader yourself, what do you see as maybe the next round of innovative products that could be important to the next 1, 2, or 3 year term for the industry? And then as part of that too, given your global experience on product, maybe take these in reverse. Do you see that products are commoditized across sports betting, or do you think it's more localized? Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, two separate questions there. I'll try and tackle them the best that I can, Quinn. You know, look, in terms of what types of products and or services will be the next trends going a few years out, I kind of talked about earlier exactly that, going to where the puck is headed as opposed to where it was. You know, if I were Nostradamus and I had a crystal ball, I guess I would know exactly which companies to invest in. But from a trend standpoint, look, you know, you look at a number of the operators, both here in the U.S. as well as globally, and I think personalization of an end user experience is certainly a little bit of where things are headed, and being able to know your customer, know their habits, and deliver to them what they're looking for, as opposed to just a vast menu of as many different markets as possible, I think is going to be something that will be really compelling for operators moving forward. So I think that we're seeing that. And look, I think that, you know, from a globalization versus a localization standpoint, everything is situation specific, right? And there's always crossover between different countries and different continents and different products. There's always different, and there's always significant differentiators as well. You can't really compare the U.S. market as an example and the consumer in the U.S. market to the consumer as an example in the Indian market, where it's so much easier to acquire customers in, say, India versus in the U.S., that each customer is spending so much less, right? It's just a difference. Sometimes there's just differences in culture and in economics that makes it a little bit difficult to look at products that would be universal from one culture to another. And by the same token, there's many that I think are adaptable from one continent or country to another. You know, you take a look at some of the trends now. I think this is another trend is towards, you know, you look at some of the products that are geared more towards, you know, some of the legislative ends and helping operators solve problems as it pertains to meeting legislative requirements. And I think that, you know, you look at something like in the UK, such as affordability, and in the UK, operators are mandated to monitor and KYC and ensure that they're not taking too much action from giving customers based on their financial situation. And that leads from the entrepreneurial side to the evolution of companies that will help solve that affordability problem. And it's specific right now to certain segments within Europe. But then you look at the U.S., will affordability become an issue in the U.S. and something that is required in certain states as regulators see the benefits of ensuring that operators are being careful as to how they take bets from customers based on how much capital they have and how much money they make? We could see that happening. So, you know, you look at some of the companies that have those types of products and where the opportunity, which may be a bit viewed more narrow today, has bigger opportunities in other countries moving forward.
Yeah, jump ahead, Chris. Yeah, I was going to say, do you see the same thing in terms of, I've seen, and Scott and I have looked at a bunch of products who are jumping from, for example, one market into the U.S. or starting here and trying to jump somewhere else. What's your guys' view on that in terms of product and identifying those for venture investment opportunities?
And with much of what we're talking about, case by case, right? I think the important things are, I'll tie back to something that Seth said earlier with maybe a slight twist about the box. I don't know that you need to be able to build the box, but you do need to know what the box looks like and have a healthy respect for the box. You have to have some sense of what it looks like and why it's there. And a lot of other things stem from that. And your market is an extension of that understanding. If you're looking to win an integration as a small supplier that might be able to improve margin by 50 bips in the U.S. good luck. You are not going to make the roadmap. If you're looking to do the same exact thing in a mature market where market share is relatively calcified, operators would kill for a 50 bip improvement in margin. So I do think that there's nothing necessarily better or worse about a given market, save that newer markets tend to attract a bit more hype, and therefore your funding path might be a little easier. You'll also probably take on quite a bit more ballast in terms of competition and expectations from those investors, et cetera. But I don't really know that one market is necessarily better or worse than another, so much as it's important to understand why those markets are different and why your ability to execute on your innovation, on your idea, can change radically from Brazil to Great Britain to, I can't think of a state in the U.S. that begins with a B. Maybe there isn't one. No, not coming up with one. If anyone on the call comes up with one, just chime in and make me look foolish. There are 50 of them. It's hard to remember all of them all the time, right?
Bama.
There we go. Even though it's sports betting in all of those states, although not in Bama, even though it's sports betting in all those states or gambling in all those states, what that means, what matters, and what you can sell in terms of innovation can change radically despite the core product itself seeming relatively similar from market to market to market.
As we're kind of getting toward the end of our hour, and we've got to start going around the table, I came up with one other question for you, Scott, and one for you, Seth. So, Scott, you know, as we've seen in this phase of venture capital over the last 2 years, how are you focusing on, or how are you thinking about the importance of operationalizing these companies under the theory, or under the hype we put together of the ecosystem of EBCI? How have you seen the success of leveraging the EBCI ecosystem to accelerate and operationalize portfolio companies? And how important do you think that was to their success that we've seen to date?
Yeah, both great questions. I think first, starting on the need and desire to operationalize these, I think it's important. We're 7 investments in, and kind of given the current environment, interest rates, right, potential economic softness, we've decided to slow down and just say, let's focus on these first 7 investments. And the fact that we're new, and we were a startup fund, so we went into this kind of somewhat blind, saying we didn't have a predetermined number of investments we were going to make. We thought it would be something in the 20 range. But as we started to make these investments, we said, well, let's slow down a little bit and let's figure out and kind of go through our portfolio. We mentioned Connectify earlier. That was one we could immediately put to use. We were their first test case. It immediately worked. We felt really good about that and said, let's figure out what's next. And whether it was on skill-based gaming, sports betting, other back-of-house or front-of-house operational opportunities, our portfolio really became very specific to the lens of, can I bring a technology in that actually fits into a bricks-and-mortar world that we can nature and nurture through this process? And really help it go live. And I think Slot Cycle is another company that probably isn't on a lot of people's radars, but we saw that one early, saying that coming after COVID, when everybody was in this mode of downsizing their slot floors, the demand for used gaming equipment was going to go up at some point. And especially with supply chain issues where, you know, the lead time as we were acquiring Southern Indiana 2 years ago to even get a new slot machine, if we placed the order at the time of close, we weren't going to see that new game for at least 12 to 14 months. So our timing, and that was purely coincidental, but our timing of that investment was terrific. And as you know, that was a company that from day one started producing revenue and has really been on a terrific trajectory because they're a Las Vegas-based company. They had in-market relationships, and now they have deals with a lot of the big players on the Strip. And it really, in a two-year-old company, their revenue performance is astronomical. So I think those are the type of things we look at. We certainly have the operational knowledge and astuteness to say, here's things that we see are happening not only around us, but in the world as a whole. And we'll continue to apply that lens as we go forward. I mean, as much as I am optimistic and bullish on where we are today, we also are not naive to say that some of our investments are going to fail. That's the nature of what we're doing here. And we have to be prepared for that failure and hope that the investments that we've made can produce enough upside from the ones that succeed that fade the ones that fail.
And I'd like to draw out one comment or one point from that as well, which is like in this space that we're all sitting in from the investment side and venture capital, working with a VC or angel investor partner for a startup in this industry that is purely a money source, I think is a different proposition, not necessarily better or worse, than working with someone or a group who either has these assets to take something to market or to beta test it, or someone from within the industry who says, I know where this product can go. I know what we can do with this product to take this with this company. I think being able to then be not only an investor, but almost in some cases on a weekly, daily basis, sitting there with some of these investment companies and helping them actually go to market. I at least in our experience, I've seen that. Benji, maybe you're disagreeing. Maybe you're thinking otherwise, but I think the closest of being able to operationalize and take things forward has been, I think, let me put it another way, it de-risks the investment, it de-risks the go-to-market.
Yeah. You know, look, I think that from an investment standpoint, we're always looking at ways to de-risk that investment in terms of going-to-market. So, you know, not much to add, Quinn, other than that, I think I would say that I agree with you.
All right, so let me get to this is the one I've been waiting for Chef, from the beginning. Tell me about
boxes.
It's all boxes. So tell me about esports and when esports as a category is going to start, erupting into the VC space in the U.S. In other jurisdictions, you know, I get it, but we've been plugging away at esports and you more than anyone. Yeah, what's your view on esports as a space?
Yeah, and specifically esports betting is what I assume you'd
be. Let's look at the betting side of the fence.
Yeah, so look, I think I do think I'll answer that in a couple different ways. So with the recent regulatory change in Nevada, I think we'll see some pickup. With Nevada operators looking at esports as a differentiator, not only the regulations changing, but it's also a time where, operators are looking to differentiate the product. So that's a part of it. But I will also say that the same reason that people found the concept and philosophy of esports interesting, and that's to tap into the gaming audience, which we know is a huge part of our population, I do think that the esports will end up being an inspiration to other ideas to get the same results. And yet, when we capture that customer, and whether it's through slot machines that have elements of video games, right? And I don't mean that they have to be games of skill. Right. So the game mechanics are the same, but you get to select your avatar, you get to select your themes through AI, you get to do things that one enjoys doing while they're playing video games. As we get to have, as more gamers come to our casino, then naturally the programming of a sports book will include esports. So where we thought esports was going to drive the gamer. Other things may drive the gamer. The gamer is going to be in our casino and say, why can't I bet on a League of Legends? The consumer, in this case, you know, the tail does have to wag the dog a bit. The consumer has to be asking for it for the operator to be providing those types of wagers. Hopefully that answers your question.
No, it does. It sounds like what one way we thought about what was going to drive esports betting to the industry is maybe the opposite, right? They're going to come for the experience, the entertainment, the venue, and then demand the product to be included in that venue.
Yeah, I would jump in when I guess relabeling esports to be experiential sports, and this is that skill money games kind of concept where if you can do something where it's, again, very live and interactive, where you're swinging a golf club or rolling a bowling ball or whatever it may be, that you can also bet on it on your own personal skill and then potentially have leaderboards and other engagement tools associated to that. I think that's a really compelling story, especially in these regional gaming markets where you don't have all the wonderful assets and amenities that a Las Vegas Strip will have in a destination-based market, that you've got to figure out the right next hook to bring customers to your business and engage them beyond just the casino floor.
Yeah, and I think we could probably close on that. I just want to close on that to say, but totally agree. I think we're going to see, if I had to predict or put on Nostradamus' hat, Benji, I would say that to pull out the crystal ball, we're not going to see digital dominate land-based in and of itself so much that land-based disappears. But I think we're going to see that experiential gaming or experiential requirements at land-based will drive or continue to drive some of the digital innovation as well. What I'm excited for is eventually seeing, I think a point that you called out, Seth, was when are we going to see more direct crossover, not necessarily even on the gaming product side, but maybe it's more on the CRM side, or maybe it's more on the experiential, I'm online digital here in this state, but now I'm in the casino here in this state, and trying to see that crossover. I think if someone can start solving the infrastructure problems around that and the technology problems, that will be, if I had to think about what to me is the most interesting stuff coming down the pipe, I think that would be something to focus on.